more than 2.5 millennia ago, they theorized loftily about the world, but did not get their hands dirty in order to test their theories. What changed in the 17th century was that these two separate rivers of human expertise flowed together and became an unstoppable flood. Science. Isaac Newton epitomized the merger of the craft and philosophy traditions. He looked at the world, theorized about why it behaved the way it did, then got his hands dirty by carrying out experiments to test his theories against reality. The idea that by observing the world systematically it was possible to gain new knowledge was extraordinarily productive. It has led us to aeroplanes and antibiotics, cars and computers, neutron stars and nuclear reactors. Why here and not there? Science, the Industrial Revolution, ocean-going ships, and so many other things were born in Europe. Together, such technologies ensured that it was Europeans who colonized the Americas and Australia and ultimately spawned our modern global society. This prompts a question. It was asked by the American geographer Jared Diamond in his book Guns, Germs, and Steel. Why did human development proceed at such different rates on different continents for the last 13,000 years? Diamond believes it was not because of any intrinsic differences in human beings. People in the Americas and Australia were not more stupid or more lazy than their European counterparts, but because of differences in their circumstances. Together, Europe and Asia, the source of so many of Europe's innovations, had a far bigger and more diverse population than either the Americas or Australia. Not only were there more societies to interact with each other, but there were more individuals within each society interacting with each other. The overall effect was to boost the exchange of ideas and accelerate the rate at which people invented new things. This, of course, prompts yet another question. Why did Europe and Asia have a bigger population than the Americas and Australia? The answer, according to Diamond, was because they had a big head start in food production. This, in turn, was because the Fertile Crescent had a wider range of habitats, from deserts to rich soils to snowy mountaintops, which created a superabundance of different plant species. At least a dozen of these were candidates for domestication, compared with only a couple in, for instance, the Americas. These domesticated species were carried by farmers as they migrated from Southwest Asia to Europe. Ultimately, the dominance of European culture comes down not to any intrinsic superiority of Europeans, but to a mere accident of birth. Even with the domestication of animals, Europe and Asia had significant advantages over the Americas and Australia. The ultimate reason for this actually predates even the birth of modern agriculture in the Fertile Crescent. It has to do with the date at which humans arrived on different continents. People flooded into Europe and Asia very early in human history. Consequently, they carried unsophisticated stone tools and were not particularly effective hunters. Animals were able to live alongside them for a long while and learn to be fearful of them. This ensured the survival of the big mammals that one day would be candidates for domestication. The Americas and Australia, on the other hand, were reached relatively recently by humans. Australia in about 50,000 BC, and the Americas only in about 14,000 BC. Consequently, the first colonists were fully modern. Far from being unsophisticated hunters, they were lethal killers. And sure enough, the arrival of humans in both Australia and the Americas appears to have coincided with the extinction of pretty much all of their giant mammals, with the exceptions of the bison in North America and the llamas and alpacas in the Andes. The result of this was that thousands of years later, when animals were first being domesticated in the Fertile Crescent, there were few suitable candidates for domestication in Australia and the Americas. The huge disadvantages people in the Americas and Australia faced in domesticating crops and domesticating animals is why their populations did not grow big enough to permit the feverish level of interaction necessary to create novel inventions. And this explains why it was the Spanish who sailed across the ocean to South America and not the Aztecs and Incas who sailed in the opposite direction to Europe. Furthermore, the empires of South America did not have horses, steel armour, or guns, which meant that bands of a few dozen mounted Spaniards were able to rout native armies numbered in thousands. In North America, the Native Americans who met the first Europeans were at an even bigger disadvantage than their cousins in the south of the continent. They possessed only weapons of stone and wood, and no animals that could be ridden. In the human catastrophe that unfolded, something like 95% of the native people of the Americas were wiped out. Although many succumbed to guns, it was not actually superior technology that killed most of the people in the Americas, not to mention Australia. It was diseases, such as smallpox and measles, brought by the Europeans. This poses yet another puzzle. "It's striking," says Diamond, "that Native Americans evolved no devastating epidemic diseases to give to Europeans in return for the many devastating epidemic diseases that Indians received from the Old World." Yet again, the explanation has to do with the head start Europe and Asia enjoyed in food production. Many human diseases originate in common domestic animals, such as pigs and chickens. Over thousands of years, the farming of many more animals and many more types of animals had created many more animal diseases. Occasionally, these spread to people and became human diseases. Measles and tuberculosis, for instance, evolved from diseases of cattle. Flu from a disease of pigs, and smallpox possibly from a disease of camels. The Americas, by contrast, had very few native domesticated animal species from which humans could catch diseases. The animal diseases that adapted themselves to humans in Europe and Asia ravaged the large population. Countless millions died, but the survivors were left with immunity, immunity that, crucially, the conquered peoples of the Americas and Australia simply did not have. "Civilization is what makes you sick," observed artist Paul Gauguin. The differences between human societies on different continents, according to Diamond, are not down to any biological differences between people, but down to differences in continental environments. Mark Twain recognized this even in the 19th century. "There are many humorous things in the world," he wrote. "Among them, the white man's notion that he is less savage than the other savages." Footprints in the Dust. Looking back over the past 13,000 years since the end of the last ice age, it is clear what the driving force of most human innovation has been. Interaction, interaction, interaction. The settlement of people, first in villages, then cities, boosted the opportunities for people to exchange ideas and ramped up the rate of technological advance. Today we have a global civilization with more than 7 billion people. And the confluence of computers and telecommunications has spawned the internet, which has exponentially boosted the number of interactions between people. In 2012, the number of text messages sent a year was estimated to be a staggering 8.7 trillion. But things are not looking good for the human race. Not only do we have the ability to destroy our global civilization in a single day with nuclear weapons, but our sheer numbers are putting the global environment under creaking strain. The climate is changing, the seas are losing their productivity, and the species we share the planet with are suffering a major extinction event. Not since the advent of cyanobacteria, which poisoned the planet with oxygen, has a single species had such a devastating effect on the Earth. All we can hope is that the unprecedented level of interactions between human beings will throw up the solutions we need to head off a catastrophe. Our extinction now would be a terrible shame, because we have come so far and achieved so much. Perhaps the most extraordinary development occurred on the 20th of July 1969, when a human being for the first time set foot on another world. In the annals of life on Earth, Neil Armstrong's "One Small Step for Man, One Giant Leap for Mankind" was the most significant development since the first amphibian crawled out of the ocean onto dry land 350 million years ago. Who would have guessed when Australopithecines left footprints in the Laetoli dust that 3.6 million years later their descendants would leave footprints in the dust of the Sea of Crisis? But let us not get carried away. Let us remember why we are here, because our farming ancestors learned the subtle art of genetic engineering. As an anonymous writer observed, man, despite his artistic pretensions, his sophistication, and his many accomplishments, owes his existence to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains. Chapter 8. Thank goodness opposites attract. Electricity. We believe that electricity exists because the electric company keeps sending us bills for it, but we cannot figure out how it travels inside wires. Dave Barry. It is a fact, or have I dreamt it, that by means of electricity, the world of matter has become a great nerve, vibrating thousands of miles in a breathless point of time. Nathaniel Hawthorne, The House of the Seven Gables, 1851. A thin metal wire comes into your home, and something invisible travels down it. The something not only has the oomph to spin the tumbler of a washing machine, but to light every room in your home, and in winter even heat your home as well. Not only your home, but millions of other homes. Billions, even. Everyone knows that electricity powers the planet, but how in the world does it do it? Here's an explanation. It requires a little background. Imagine there is a force that behaves like gravity, but differs from gravity in two key respects. First, instead of separate chunks of matter always attracting each other in the way that the Sun and Earth do, there are two types of matter that experience the force differently. Call them type 1 and type 2, or A and B, or positive and negative. It does not matter. The key thing is that unlikes attract with a force, while likes repel with the same force. A bunch of positives therefore repel and flee from each other in all directions, and a bunch of negatives does exactly the same. However, with an evenly mixed bunch of positives and negatives, something quite different happens. The opposite pieces pull each other together, and the like pieces drive each other apart. But because the opposing forces are equal and opposite, there is a perfect balance. It follows that if there are two bodies, each of which is an equal mixture of negatives and positives, they will neither attract nor repel each other. A force that behaves like this does indeed exist. It is called the electric force. And ordinary matter, the stuff of which you and me and the world around us is made, turns out to be an even mixture of positively charged protons and negatively charged electrons. protons are confined to the core or nucleus of each atom, whereas electrons orbit the nucleus. The balance of attraction and repulsion is so perfect that when you stand near someone else, neither of you feels the slightest force. In fact, in everyday life, there is very little hint that the electric force exists at all. A force that can be both attractive and repulsive, but which, in normal circumstances, is cancelled out perfectly, probably seems dull and unremarkable. But remember, the electric force differs from gravity in not one, but two respects. While the first difference ensures that the force is pretty much always nullified, the second difference is at the very root of the force's extraordinary ability to power the modern world. The electric force is stronger than gravity, but not by a factor of 10, or of 100, or even a million. No, the electric force is stronger than the force of gravity by a factor of 10,000 billion, 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 billion. To get some idea of what this enormous number means, imagine a mosquito buzzing in a jar. Say, by some wizardry, it is possible to remove all the negative electrons from the atoms of the mosquito so that all that are left behind are the positive atomic nuclei. These will, of course, repel each other. The mosquito will explode. The question is, with how much energy will the mosquito explode? A. The energy of a sparkler. B. The energy of a stick of dynamite. C. The energy of a 1 megaton H-bomb. D. The energy of a global mass extinction. Perhaps you think the answer is B, a stick of dynamite, or maybe C, a 1 megaton H-bomb. If you think C, you are at least on the right track. A hydrogen bomb is a useful comparison, but not a single hydrogen bomb. A million billion 1 megaton H-bombs. The mosquito will explode with an energy equivalent to the city-sized asteroid that slammed into the Earth 65 million years ago and wiped out the dinosaurs. The answer is D. The mosquito will explode with the energy of a global mass extinction. Were it not for the fact that the mind-bogglingly huge electric force, 10,000 billion, 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 billion times stronger than gravity, is invariably cancelled out, each and every mosquito on Earth would be a potential world destroyer. Thank goodness that in physics, as in life, opposites attract. Now perhaps it is possible to appreciate the potential of the electric force for energizing the world. Removing all the electrons from a mosquito, if it were possible, would create a dramatic charge imbalance and unleash a truly extraordinary amount of electric energy. It follows that creating even a modest charge imbalance might unleash a significant amount of electric energy. This is what happens in a thunderstorm. Here, a charge imbalance builds up between a cloud and the ground, or more commonly, between one cloud and another. Specifically, the underside of a cloud builds up a negative charge at the expense of the ground, which becomes positively charged. Eventually, the electric force between the cloud and the ground becomes so immensely strong that it is able to rip the outer electrons from the atoms in the air between. This breakdown of the air sends an avalanche of electrons, typically 100 billion billion of them, surging down to the ground to cancel out the charge imbalance. In short, it creates a lightning bolt. A flow of electrons is called an electric current. Typically, in the case of a lightning bolt, the current is about 10,000 amps, though it can be as high as a few hundred thousand amps. By comparison, many household electrical appliances use less than 10 amps. For just a tenth of a second or so, the current surges down a channel the width of a pencil. The electrons that compose it slam into air atoms like a myriad tiny ball bearings, transferring energy to their still-bound electrons. The air atoms gain so much energy that the temperature can soar to about 50,000 degrees centigrade, almost 10 times hotter than the surface of the sun. It is the supersonic expansion of this blisteringly hot air on either side of the lightning channel that creates the clap of thunder. And it is the atomic electrons shedding their excess energy as photons that light up the lightning bolt. Lightning demonstrates some key properties of electricity. One is that if a charge imbalance is created, the electric force is presented with an opportunity to unleash a large amount of energy. Another is that electrical energy can be transferred across a distance by an electric current. In a lightning bolt, the distance is typically a couple of kilometres. However, the longest recorded streak of lightning observed near Dallas, Texas, was almost 200 kilometres long. The ability to transfer energy across a distance by an electric current has been of huge significance in creating the modern technological world. Lastly, of course, lightning demonstrates that by means of an electric current, it is possible to change electrical energy into other forms of energy, specifically heat and light. The killer app responsible for kick-starting the electrical revolution of the late 19th century was, in fact, the light bulb. The electrical pioneers were not thinking about putting electricity into the home or even electrical appliances in the home. They were thinking about putting light in the home. "The light bulb is what wired the world," says Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon.com. Just as a current in lightning transfers energy to the air, heating and lighting it up, a current in a light bulb transfers energy to a filament, heating and lighting it up. The clever bit, perfected, though not invented, by Thomas Edison, is putting a filament in an oxygen-free glass bulb so that it glows without burning away. But although lightning demonstrates some key properties of electricity, building up a huge charge imbalance and waiting for the air to break down catastrophically is hardly a practical way to generate an electric current. Fortunately, there is a more convenient and controlled way. To understand it, however, it is first necessary to appreciate how exactly the electric force of an electric charge reaches out across space and influences other charges. The electric force field. If you rub a balloon against a nylon sweater, loose electrons get transferred from one to the other. It does not matter which way they go, and, in fact, it is not entirely clear. The point is that both the balloon and sweater become electrically charged. If you now bring the charged-up balloon close to a small scrap of paper, the paper will leap through the air, yanked by the electric force, and glue itself to the balloon. Somehow, the electric force of the balloon has reached out through the air and grabbed the scrap of paper. Physicists say that extending out through space from an electric charge is an invisible electric force field, rather like a Star Trek tractor beam. When the paper finds itself in the field, it experiences a force towards the charge. The field of force around a charged balloon is feeble, but between a storm cloud and another cloud, or between a cloud and the ground, it can be enormous. And it is this field that eventually becomes so irresistibly strong that it tears electrons from the very atoms of the air, creating the electron avalanche of a lightning bolt. In fact, the field in a thunderstorm can be strong enough to be felt, prickling the skin and even making the hair stand on end. Mind you, if you experience either of these sensations, throw yourself flat to the ground. A lightning strike is imminent, and your name is written on it. The magnetic force field. But there is more to the electric field than an invisible force field that extends outwards from an electric charge, pulling in unlike charges and pushing away like charges. This merely describes the force surrounding a static charge. If the charge is moving relative to a second charge, a new force puts in an appearance. The second charge, in addition to the electric force, experiences a magnetic force. The magnetic force field is easier to imagine than an electric force field. After all, if you have a bar magnet and a nail and bring them together, you can actually feel the invisible tractor beam of the magnetic field of the magnet clamping onto the nail. In fact, it was seeing the needle of a magnetic compass respond to the Earth's magnetic field that blew the mind of Albert Einstein, aged 4 or 5, switching him on to science and teaching him a lesson about nature that he never forgot. There is something behind things, something deeply hidden. The fact that a magnetic field is caused by a moving electric charge helps explain the origin of the magnetic field of permanent magnets. Every material, including the flesh and blood of which you are made, consists of countless charged electrons, not only moving in orbit around the nuclei of atoms, but actually behaving like tiny spinning tops themselves. This means every atom and every electron is like a tiny magnet. In most materials, all the countless mini-magnets are orientated randomly, and so overall their magnetic fields cancel out. However, in some materials, this cancellation is not perfect. Such materials are permanent magnets. The fact that a moving electric charge creates a magnetic field was first noticed in 1820 by Danish physicist Hans Christian Oersted. He saw that the needle of a magnetic compass was deflected when he brought it close to a conducting wire carrying an electric current. A current, by definition, is electric charge in motion, and electric charge in motion obviously has a changing electric field. What Oersted realized was that a changing electric field creates a magnetic field. Bring two magnets together and feel the powerful force between them. As Oersted discovered, a current-carrying coil of wire with its changing electric field is a magnet. Bring it together with a permanent magnet and there will be a force between the two, just as there would be between two permanent magnets. Arrange the coil and the magnet in the right way, and this takes some ingenuity, and the force will cause the coil of wire to spin. Voila! You have created an electric motor. The reason a magnetic field can spin something is that it has what physicists call curl. Whereas an electric field extends radially outwards from a charge, a magnetic field, for instance one created by a current-carrying wire, swirls around like a miniature tornado of force. With the aid of an electric motor, it is possible to do a lot more with an electric current than merely create heat and light. It is possible to move things. In the motor of an electrical appliance, the changing electric field of an electric current generates a magnetic field of the force that propels a spindle. It is possible to drive everything from washing machines to automatic doors to electric cars and trains, and this is all down to the simple fact that a changing electric field creates a magnetic field. Of course, it goes without saying that the prerequisite for running an electric motor is an electric current. Nature can create one, fleetingly and chaotically, in a lightning bolt. But how is it possible to create an electric current in a practical and controlled way? The answer is by exploiting another property of electric and magnetic fields. It was first noticed in 1831 by English physicist Michael Faraday. Faraday was the father of our electrical power system. "Even if I could be Shakespeare, I think that I should still choose to be Faraday," wrote Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World, and famously, when asked by William Gladstone, Chancellor of the British Exchequer, "What is the practical use of electricity?" Faraday replied, "Why, sir, there is every probability that you will soon be able to tax it." Faraday noticed that when he moved a magnet in the vicinity of a coil of conducting wire, an electric current flowed fleetingly in the coil. A current is a flow of charges, and charges are propelled by an electric field. What Faraday had noticed was that a changing magnetic field creates an electric field. There is a pleasing symmetry between electric and magnetic fields. Not only does a changing electric field create a magnetic field, but a changing magnetic field creates an electric field. Spin a coil of wire in the magnetic field of a permanent magnet. Arrange the coil and magnet in the right way, and this also takes some ingenuity, and an electric field will be created in the coil, which will drive a current. Voila, you have created an electric generator. At a power station, a coil of wire is spun in the force field of a magnet. The thing doing the spinning could be wind or water, or steam from water heated by coal or oil or nuclear power. The key thing is that the spinning coil cuts through the magnetic field. In other words, the magnetic field through the coil changes, and the changing magnetic field creates an electric field, which pushes electrons around the coil. It creates a current, the same current that surges out of the power station, down a cable, and powers your home. In practice, the current goes in and out of each home in the same cable. The current arrives from the power station in the live wire and returns to the power station in the neutral wire, thus completing the circuit. There is a twist, however. Although the statement above is basically true, power stations do not generate current that flows in one direction only. Instead of direct current, or DC, they generate alternating current, or AC, which sloshes back and forth, rapidly changing its direction. The reason for this is to overcome a major problem with the long-distance transmission of electricity. Alternating current. Think of an electric current flowing from a power station like a stream flowing down a hillside to a valley bottom. If you were to intercept the stream near the top of the hill, you would be able to exploit the long drop of the water to the valley bottom to power a piece of machinery, such as a water wheel. However, if you were to intercept the stream close to the valley bottom, there would be very little drop left that could be exploited. And this is also the problem with an electric current flowing from a power station. The further away a home, the less energy can be extracted from the flow of electrons, while those close to the power station might be able to light their homes with a multitude of bright light bulbs, those far away will have to make do with the faintest of glimmers from a single light bulb. The amount of energy a current can deliver is characterized by its voltage, which is analogous to the height of that stream above the valley bottom. In the UK, domestic appliances work on 240 volts, 110 volts in the US. This would seem to imply that a power station would have to generate electricity at near 240 volts. But of course, if it did, those living far away might have to do with 100 volts, or 10, or even a measly 1 volt. In New York in the 1880s, the only way Edison could overcome this Achilles heel of electric power transmission was to build a power station about every 2.5 kilometers. Although this is just about doable, it is clearly an unworkable solution for distributing electrical power nationally. The solution to the transmission problem pioneered by Nikola Tesla and others is to generate the electrical power not at 240 volts, but at a voltage about 1,000 times greater. In the UK's national grid, electricity is transmitted over long distances at 110,000 volts or higher. This means that if the electrons lose energy travelling down the wire from a power station, and they inevitably do, banging into atoms and losing energy as heat, the voltage drop is hardly noticeable compared with 110,000 volts. Consequently, it is possible to transmit electricity over huge distances, and power stations do not have to be near homes. The problem is that 110,000 volts is too enormous for household appliances. Somewhere between a power station and people's homes, the voltage must be reduced or stepped down. This is not possible with a direct current, but it is possible with an alternating current. An alternating current switches direction rapidly, commonly between 50 and 60 times a second. Think of the electrons in a wire as sloshing back and forth like waves on a seashore. And since an alternating current is ultimately made of countless moving electrons, exactly like a direct current, it can carry energy as efficiently as its unidirectional cousin. Furthermore, it is possible to design both a generator to create alternating current and a motor to run on alternating current. There remains only the problem of stepping down an AC current from 110,000 volts to the 240 volts required domestically. But this can be done with a transformer. In a transformer, a current changing in one coil of wire, that is, an alternating current, causes a changing magnetic field in a second coil. This, in turn, creates a changing electrical field, which drives a changing current in the second coil. If the second coil has fewer turns than the first, then the voltage goes down. So there you have it, our electrical power system in a nutshell. Electricity, magnetism, and light. But electricity and magnetism have some more tricks up their sleeve. Recall that if an electric charge is moving relative to you, you see not only an electric field, but a magnetic field. However, if you travel alongside the charge so that it is not moving relative to you, you see no magnetic field. And that is not all. If a magnet is moving relative to you, you see not only a magnetic field, but an electric field. But if you travel alongside the magnet, you see only a magnetic field. How is it possible that from one perspective there is a magnetic field and from another no magnetic field? How is it possible that from one perspective there is an electric field and from another no electric field? There is only one way it can be possible, if magnetic fields and electric fields are not fundamental things at all. As Einstein realized in 1905, an electric field and a magnetic field, just like space and time, are simply different facets of the same thing, an electromagnetic field. How much of each facet you see depends on your speed relative to the source of the electromagnetic field. This is why what one person sees as an electric field, someone else sees as an electric field and a magnetic field. This is why what one person sees as a magnetic field, someone else sees as a magnetic field and an electric field. No wonder there is a pleasing symmetry between the behavior of electric and magnetic fields. How can there not be? They are essentially the same thing. But there is yet more. In 1863, the Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell, in a scientific tour de force, distilled all known electrical and magnetic phenomena into a single neat set of equations. Studying those equations, he noticed something remarkable. It appeared possible for a ripple to propagate through the electric and magnetic fields just like a wave on a lake. Not only was the ripple self-sustaining, but it travelled at a very particular speed. The speed of light. Maxwell had discovered a surprising connection between electricity and magnetism and light. Light, it turns out, is a wave of electromagnetism, an electromagnetic wave. And there is more. Maxwell's equations reveal that it is possible to have electromagnetic waves that oscillate both more rapidly and more sluggishly than visible light. In 1888, their existence was proved by the German physicist Heinrich Hertz. With the aid of a spark, he transmitted an electromagnetic wave. The invisible to the naked eye radio wave crossed his laboratory and induced a measurable current in a coil of wire. It was an epochal, world-changing moment. All radio and television communications around the world began with that one triumphant demonstration. Our connected modern world was born that day. From a long view of the history of mankind, seen from, say, 10,000 years from now, there can be little doubt that the most significant event of the 19th century will be judged as Maxwell's discovery of the laws of electrodynamics, said American Nobel Prize winner Richard Feynman. Electricity and the realm of the atom. Electricity opened up technological possibilities that were unimaginable to earlier generations. Not only was it possible to transmit a signal around the globe so that one person could talk to another without any material connection existing between them, but it was possible to run huge extended power systems. In the evocative words of Feynman, 10,000 engines in 10,000 places running the machines of industries and homes, all turning because of the knowledge of electromagnetism. But hand in hand with the harnessing of electricity came a dawning realization that electricity is of central importance in nature. We live in an electrical world. Nobody had realized this before because, in pretty much all everyday circumstances, the enormous electric forces are perfectly balanced and so nullified. This is not the case, however, in the realm of the atom, the building block of all matter. There, charge imbalances are ubiquitous. As the joke goes, two atoms are walking down the street when they collide. One says to the other, "Are you all right?" "No, I lost an electron." "Are you sure?" "Yeah, I'm positive." In a piece of matter with only a few atoms, there will usually not be an equal number of positive and negative charges, and even if there are, there might still be large electrical forces. This is because the negative charge of one piece of matter might be closer to the positive charge of another piece of matter than its negative charge. Since the electrical force weakens with distance, attraction will win out over repulsion. Thus, it is possible for two small pieces of matter to attract each other fiercely, even if neither has a net charge. Atoms, it turns out, are totally dominated by the immensely strong electric force. The glue that holds them together and sticks them to other atoms to make molecules is the electrical force. All chemistry which involves the rearrangement of electrons in atoms is electrical. The attraction of the electrical force not only holds the atoms in the molecules of your body together, but the repulsion between the electrons on the outside of those molecules keeps you rigid, preventing the Earth's gravity from crushing you flat. And your cells have learned how to tap the energy of the electric force. Electrons from food create electric fields across cell walls that drive the creation of power-pack molecules such as adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, and electrons help to store and carry our very thoughts. Biology runs on electricity. We are electrical beings. We are as animated by the electrical force as much as a battery-powered toy is animated by the electrical force. Which explains why electricity is not only miraculous, but dangerous. "My nephew tried to stick a penny into a plug," said American comedian Tim Allen. "Whoever said a penny doesn't go far didn't see him shoot across that floor." Chapter 9. Programmable Matter. Computers. One day ladies will take their computers for walks in the park and tell each other, "My little computer said such a funny thing this morning." Alan Turing.
I think the world market for computers is maybe
5. Thomas J. Watson, chairman of IBM, 1943.
"Computers are useless," said Pablo Picasso. "They can only give you answers."
But what answers they give. In the past half a century, those answers have dramatically changed our world. The computer is unlike any other human invention. A washing machine is a washing machine is a washing machine. It is impossible to change it into a vacuum cleaner, or a toaster, or a nuclear reactor. But a computer can be a word processor, or an interactive video game, or a smartphone. And the list goes on and on and on. The computer's unique selling point is that it can simulate any other machine, although we have yet to build computers that can fabricate stuff quite as flexibly as human beings, it is merely a matter of time. Fundamentally, a computer is just a shuffler of symbols. A bunch of symbols goes in, perhaps the altitude, ground speed, and so on of an aeroplane, and another bunch of symbols comes out. For instance, the amount of jet fuel to burn, the necessary changes to be made in the angle of ailerons, and so on. The thing that changes the input symbols into the output symbols is a program, a set of instructions that is stored internally and, crucially, is infinitely rewritable. The reason a computer can simulate any other machine is that it is programmable. It is the extraordinary versatility of the computer program that is at the root of the unprecedented, world-conquering power of the computer. The first person to imagine an abstract machine that shuffles symbols on the basis of a stored program was the English mathematician Alan Turing, famous for his role in breaking the German Enigma and Fish codes, which arguably shortened the Second World War by several years. Turing's symbol shuffler, devised in the 1930s, is unrecognizable as a computer. Its program is stored on a one-dimensional tape in binary, as a series of noughts and ones. Because everything, including numbers and instructions, can ultimately be reduced to binary digits. Precisely how it works, with a read-write head, changing the digits one at a time, is not important. The crucial thing is that Turing's machine can be fed a description of any other machine, encoded in binary, and then simulate that machine. Because of this unprecedented ability, Turing called it a universal machine. Today, it is referred to as a universal Turing machine. Bizarrely, Turing devised his machine of the mind not to show what a computer can do, but what it cannot do. He was at heart a pure mathematician, and what interested him, even before the advent of nuts and bolts hardware, was the ultimate limits of computers. Remarkably, Turing very quickly found a simple task that no computer, no matter how powerful, could ever do. It is called the halting problem, and it is easily stated. Computer programs can sometimes get caught in endless loops, running around the same set of instructions forever, like a demented hamster in a wheel. The halting problem says, if a computer is given a computer program, can it tell, ahead of actually running the program, whether it will eventually halt? That is, that it will not get caught in an interminable loop. Turing, by clever reasoning, showed that deciding whether a program eventually halts or goes on forever is logically impossible, and therefore beyond the capability of any conceivable computer. In the jargon, it is uncomputable. Thankfully, the halting problem turns out not to be typical of the kind of problems we use computers to solve. Turing's limit on computers has, therefore, not held us back. And despite their rather surprising birth in the abstract field of pure mathematics as machines of the imagination, computers have turned out to be immensely practical devices. A vast numerical irrigation system. Computers, like the universal Turing machine, use binary. Binary was invented by Gottfried Leibniz, a 17th century German mathematician who clashed bitterly with Isaac Newton over who had invented calculus. Binary is a way of representing numbers as strings of noughts and ones. Usually we use decimal, or base 10. The right-hand digit represents the ones, the next digit the tens, the next the 10 by tens, and so on. So, for instance, 9217 means 7 plus 1 times 10 plus 2 times, in brackets, 10 times 10 plus 9 times, in brackets, 10 times 10 times 10. In binary, or base 2, the right-hand digit represents the ones, the next digit the twos, the next the 2 times twos, and so on. So, for instance, 1101 means 1 plus 0 times 2 plus 1 times, in brackets, 2 times 2, close brackets, plus 1 times, in brackets, 2 times 2 times 2, close brackets, which in decimal is 13. Binary can be used to represent not only numbers but also instructions. It is merely necessary to specify that this particular string of binary digits or bits means add. This one means multiply. This one execute these instructions and go back to the beginning and execute them again, and so on. And it is not only numbers and program instructions that can be represented in binary. Binary can encode anything, from the information content of an image of Saturn's rings sent back by the Cassini spacecraft to the information content of a human being, although this is somewhat beyond our current capabilities. This has led some physicists, drunk on the information revolution, to suggest that binary information is the fundamental bedrock of the universe out of which physics emerges. It from bit, as the American physicist John Wheeler memorably put it. Binary is particularly suitable for use in computers because representing noughts and ones in hardware requires devices that can be set only to two distinct states. Take the storage of information. This can be done with a magnetic medium, tiny regions of which can be magnetized in one direction to represent a naught and in the opposite direction to represent a one. Think of an array of miniature compass needles. To manipulate the information, on the other hand, an electronic device that has two distinct states is necessary. Such a device is the transistor. Imagine a garden hose through which water is flowing. The water comes from a source and ends up in a drain. Now imagine stepping on the middle of the hose. The flow of water chokes off. Essentially, this is all a transistor in a computer does. Except, of course, it controls not a flow of water, but a flow of electrons, an electrical current. And instead of a foot, it has a gate. Applying a voltage to the gate controls the flow of electrons from the source to the drain, as surely as stepping on a hose controls the flow of water. When the current is switched on, it can represent a one, and when it is off, a naught. Simples. A modern transistor on a microchip actually looks like a tiny T. The top crossbar of the T is the source, or drain, the hose, and the upright of the T is the gate, the foot. Now imagine two transistors connected together. That is, the source of one transistor is connected to the drain of another. This is just like having a hose beside which you and a friend are standing. If you step on the hose, no water will flow. If your friend steps on it, no water will flow either. If you both stand on the hose, once again, no water will flow. Only if you do not stand on the hose and your friend does not stand on the hose will water flow. In the case of the transistor, electrons will flow only if there is a certain voltage on the first gate and the same voltage on the second gate. It is also possible to connect up transistors so that electrons will flow if there is a particular voltage on the first gate or on the second gate. Such and OR gates are just two possibilities among a host of logic gates that can be made from combinations of transistors. Just as atoms can be combined into molecules, and molecules into human beings, transistors can be combined into logic gates, and logic gates into things such as adders, which sum two binary numbers. And by combining millions of such components, it is possible to make a computer. Computers are composed of nothing more than logic gates stretched out to the horizon in a vast numerical irrigation system, said Stan Algarten, an American writer on the history of computing. Cities on chips. Transistors are made from one of the most common and mundane substances on the planet, sand. Or, rather, they are made from silicon, the second most abundant element in the Earth's crust, and one component of the silicon dioxide of sand. Silicon is neither a conductor of electricity, through which electrons flow easily, nor an insulator, through which electrons cannot flow. Crucially, however, it is a semiconductor. Its electrical properties can be radically altered merely by doping it with a tiny number of atoms of another element. Silicon can be doped with atoms such as phosphorus and arsenic, which bond with it to leave a single leftover electron that can be given up or donated. This transforms it into a conductor of negative electrons, or an N-type material. But silicon can also be doped with atoms such as boron and gallium, which bond with silicon and leave room for one more electron. Bizarrely, the empty space where an electron isn't can move through the material exactly as if it is a positively charged electron. This transforms the silicon into a conductor of positive holes, or a P-type material. A transistor is created simply by making a PNP or an NPN sandwich, most commonly an NPN. You do not need to know any more than this to grasp the basics of transistors. In fact, you already know more than you need. In the beginning, when transistors were first invented, they had to be linked together individually to make logic gates and computer components such as adders. But the computer revolution has been brought about by a technology that creates or integrates billions upon billions of transistors simultaneously on a single wafer or chip of silicon. The very large-scale integration of such integrated circuits is complex and expensive, but in a nutshell, it involves etching a pattern of transistors on a wafer of silicon, then layer by layer, depositing doping atoms, microscopic wires, and so on. To make a computer, you need a computer. It is only with computer-aided design that it is possible to create a pattern of transistors as complex as a major city. Such a pattern is then made into a mask. Think of it as a photographic negative. By shining light through the mask onto a wafer of silicon, it is possible to create an image of the pattern of transistors. But a pattern of light and shadows is just that, a pattern of light and shadows. The trick is to turn it into something real. This can be done if the surface of the silicon wafer is coated with a special chemical that undergoes a chemical change when struck by light. Crucially, light makes the photoresistant material resistant to attack by acid. So, when acid is applied to the silicon wafer in the next step of the process, the silicon is eaten away, or etched, everywhere except where the light falls. Hey presto, the image of the mask has been turned into concrete, or rather, silicon reality. There are many other ingenious steps in the process, which might involve using many masks to create multiple layers, spraying the wafer with dopants, and spraying on microscopic gold connecting wires, and so on. But basically, this is the idea. The technique of photolithography quickly and elegantly impresses the pattern of a complex electric circuit onto the wafer. It creates a city on a chip. Probably most people think that microchips originate in the US or in Japan or South Korea. Surprisingly, they are born in Britain. The company behind the designs of the overwhelming majority of the chips in the world's electronic devices is based in Cambridge. ARM started out as Acorn Computers in 1985. While the big chip makers like Intel in the US concentrated on making faster and more compact chips for desktop computers, or PCs, ARM struck out in a different direction completely. It put entire computers on a chip. This made possible the vast numbers of compact and mobile electronic devices, from sat-navs to games consoles to mobile phones. It moved chips from dedicated and unwieldy computers into the everyday world. Big Bang Computing. The limit on how small components can be made on a chip is determined by the kind of light that is shone through a mask. Chip makers have made ever smaller components, packing in more and more transistors by using light with a shorter wavelength, such as ultraviolet or X-rays, which can squeeze through smaller holes. They have even replaced light with beams of electrons, since electrons have a shorter wavelength than light, and chips have become ever more powerful. In 1965, Gordon Moore, one of the founders of the American computer chip maker Intel, pointed out that the computational power available at a particular price, or equivalently, the number of transistors on a chip, appears to double roughly every 18 months. If the automobile had followed the same development cycle as a computer, a Rolls-Royce would today cost $100, get 1 million miles per gallon, and explode once a year, killing everyone inside, observed Robert X. Cringely, technology columnist on InfoWorld magazine. People have been claiming that Moore's law is about to break down every decade since it was formulated, but so far, everyone has been wrong. Undoubtedly, however, Moore's law will break down one day. It is a sociological law, a law of human ingenuity. But even human ingenuity cannot do the impossible. There are physical limits set by the laws of nature which are impossible to circumvent, that ultimately determine the limits of computers. The speed of a computer, the number of logical operations it can perform a second, turns out to be limited by the total energy available. Today's laptops are so slow because they use only the electrical energy in transistors. But this energy is totally dwarfed by the energy locked away in the mass of the computer, which provides nothing more than the scaffolding to keep a computer stable. The ultimate laptop would have all of its available energy in processing and none of its energy in its mass. In other words, it would have its mass energy converted into light energy, as permitted by Einstein's famous E equals mc squared formula. The computing power of such a device would be formidable. In a 10 millionth of a second, it would be able to carry out a calculation that would take a state-of-the-art computer today, the age of the universe, to complete. But it would carry out the calculation at a price. If all the available energy is converted into light energy for computing, a computer would not be anything like a familiar computer. Far from it. It would be a billion-degree ball of light. It would be like a nuclear fireball, a blindingly bright piece of the Big Bang. Though it might be nice to have the most powerful computer imaginable on your desk, it might be just a little inconvenient. Chapter 10. The Invention of Time Travel. Money.
Money is not metal, it is trust inscribed.
Niall Ferguson, The Ascent of Money.
If people understood how money was created, there would be a revolution before breakfast.
Henry Ford.
When I was young, I thought that money was the most important thing in life, wrote Oscar Wilde. Now that I am old, I know that it is.
Money, as Wilde was certainly not the first or last to realize, makes the world go round. But what exactly is money, and how did it originate? Most people would say that we use money to trade for goods and services. I give you my money in exchange for your goods. Or, alternatively, you give me your money in exchange for my goods. So behind the question, what is money, lies a deeper, more basic question. What is trade? Rewind the clock maybe 100,000 years. One of our ancestors catches fish. His neighbour makes hand axes. Both need fish and hand axes. Say the fisherman catches 8 fish in the time it takes the axe maker to fashion 4 axes. Now the fisherman could spend half his time catching 4 fish and half his time making hand axes, but he is not as skilled or as fast at making hand axes as the axe maker, so he struggles to make 1 inferior axe. Similarly, the axe maker could spend half his time making 2 hand axes and half his time catching fish, but maybe he is not skilled or fast at catching fish, so he struggles to catch 2. This is when one of the men has a genius idea, which he persuades the other makes perfect sense. Rather than each of us doing both things, why don't we both exclusively do the thing we are best at, then trade our products? So they do. and the fisherman swaps 4 of his 8 fish for 2 of the axe maker's hand axes. He therefore ends up with 4 fish and 2 hand axes, which is better than 4 fish and 1 hand axe he would have had if he had fished and made hand axes. At the same time, the axe maker ends up with 4 fish and 2 hand axes, which is better than the 2 fish and 2 hand axes he would have had if he too had made hand axes and fished. It seems like a miracle. Both have benefited, and all because of a simple act, trading. Of course, the fisherman and the axe maker could have agreed on another exchange rate which was equally advantageous to both. And even if the fisherman ends up with the same number of hand axes as when he makes them himself, they are likely to be of superior quality. Similarly, if the axe maker ends up with the same number of fish as when he catches them himself, they are likely to be bigger and tastier, coming as they do from a better, more experienced fisherman. Trading in this way clearly relies on both parties being honourable. The axe-maker could renege on the deal, taking the fish but not handing over the agreed hand-axes. However, if the fisherman and axe-maker belong to the same group or tribe, there may be an existing template for honourable trade. After all, men being stronger may hunt for meat, which they exchange or trade for fruit and berries collected by women. Also, if women move to other tribes to find mates, this may gradually widen the trading circle. Although there is no way to rule out the possibility of cheating, there might be strong incentives not to cheat, which outweigh any tendency to double-cross. The trading between the fisherman and the axe-maker is limited, however, because it requires 2 people to meet face-to-face. An obvious way to boost opportunities for trade is to get a lot of people with a lot of tradable goods together in one place. Such an innovation is a marketplace. If there are several fishermen and several axe-makers, not to mention bead-makers, fur suppliers, fruit collectors, and so on, then they might meet at some place at regular intervals to trade,